Tim Whitcomb, alcoholic.
Tim.
I'm grateful to be sober today. Glad to be here. I never know what I'm going to say when I get up here. I don't have a set thing that I do. I just say a little prayer ahead of time, and then I get up and start talking. I can assure you of this much, the talk I give here this evening will not be nearly as good as the one I gave in the shower getting ready to come up here. That one was crisp, and I wish several of you could have been there for it, you know. Now, you'll notice I wasn't looking at anybody when I said that, you know, because that's just an old joke I've used many times trying to get comfortable up here, but I delivered that line one night and realized I was staring right into somebody's eyes when I said it. And I'm pretty sure I made that guy nervous, you know. He was new, wondering what he got himself into, you know. I'm sober since January the 3rd, 1983. Very grateful for that. I have a home group, men who have lost their legs. We meet on Thursday nights in Santa Barbara. If any of you are ever down our way, the Veterans Memorial Building, 8 o'clock, men who have lost their legs. I have a sponsor. His name is Rick Mohun. Rick is 56 years of continuous sobriety. And if you're praying people, and I assume most of you are, I'd appreciate if you'd throw a little one up there for my sponsor, because he's not doing too well physically at this moment. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It saved my life. It gave me the opportunity to have two lives in one lifetime. You know, there's the way I was and what I did, and then I got to you guys, and it's, for the last 32 years, it's been something different. And I still curse my first sponsor once in a while, because his teaching was, you're going to get asked to talk, and what your job is at that point when they ask you is to look at your day timer, and if the time is available and open, then you say yes. So that's what I do. And then I curse about it later, you know, thinking, why did I? So I love the whole thing about, you know, we'd come up here in the car, four of us and the other car, and we have fun on the way up, and then we have dinner. You know, I like to throw food into the mix anytime I get a chance, and there's always this point in time, usually somewhere right in the middle of dinner, where I'm just, you know, I'm having a ball. It's like, this is good. I'm surrounded by my friends, and then it'll hit me. You know, you got to go talk. It's like, oh, God. It's my least favorite part of this thing, and may end up being your least favorite part of it, too, you know. So I wish you could have been there for dinner, because that part was good. We're driving over here, and I tell these guys a little joke. Yeah. Teacher asks the kids, draw a picture of the nativity. So one guy, hey, the little kid hands in his drawing, and she says, oh, that's very good, Johnny. You know, I see, you know, the animals and the creature and all that stuff. But, you know, but who's this little fat guy down here? And he says, oh, that's Round John Virgin. You know, Round John Virgin, mother and child. And that's pretty much the same reaction I got in the car. In fact, in the car, there was dead silence. You know? It's like, that's a joke, people. It reminded me, at one point in my life, during my drinking days, I moved to a little town named Jerome, Arizona. up from Sedona, up from Cornville and Cottonwood, Clarkdale, in that area. And I get to town, and I go downtown, which is three blocks long, and there's two bars. So I walked into the first one. It was called the Spirit Room. And we got the jukebox going, Creedence Clearwater. People are dancing, they're shooting pool. Young, hippie, you know, kids. And sort of like I was at that point in my life. This will do, but I'm going to go check out the other one. And I walked over to the other bar, and I opened the door, and it's like that cigarette smoke hit me, you know. So thick you had to kind of go like this to see through it. They got George Jones playing on the jukebox. There's six guys sitting there. None of them talking to each other. They're all staring straight ahead into that mirror. They all got their shot and their beer in front of them. I went, ah, this is it. This is, you know, found home now. So I walk in, I sit down, I get my shot and my beer. Sitting there for a couple of minutes, and one of these guys goes, eight. And everybody goes, well, that's kind of strange. A few minutes later, a guy goes, 14. Everybody goes, so I call the bartender down. I says, what's with the numbers? He says, these guys have been sitting here drinking together for so long, they just took all the jokes and numbered them so they don't have to bother telling the whole thing. Well, can I try one? He says, go ahead. I went, 24. Dead silence. I says, what's the matter? Isn't 24 funny? He says, oh, it's hilarious. But you know how it is. Some guys can tell a joke and some guys can't. I want to thank my friend Lee for asking me to come. It's always good to just hear from Lee. And you know, I recently married him. I performed the ceremony for he and Joey. Let's put it that way. My friend Lee, I've known him for a long time, and my friend Lenny, you know, Leonard, is he? Refers to himself now, but the guy leading the meeting, I've known him for years and years, and hired him at one point. He worked for me for quite a while. Lenny B. Flippin, we used to say. Man, that Lenny B. Flippin. you know, my relationship with Lee goes back to... I was at the Santa Barbara Convention, I don't know how many years ago it's been now, maybe 20, and found myself at one of the meals, a luncheon or a banquet or something, and I'm sitting next to this guy, and we start chatting, and he says, yeah, I work at the federal prison. I said, oh man, I've been trying to get into that federal prison, you know, but they won't let me. And it evolved, you know, our whole thing evolved from there to the point where, you know, Lee was working at the prison at that point in time, and I put in paperwork again, and he hand carried it to the AW, to the associate warden or someone, or the warden, and said, I'll vouch for this guy personally. This is the kind of guy we need in here for our meetings. And got me cleared, and I've been cleared ever since. That now they can't get rid of me. You know, I've got a badge, and I go in. So these long-term friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous just mean more and more to me. My friend Richard's here tonight, and Hopper. So, I used to drink. You know, I should probably tell you that. I finally hit bottom with that. which I define as things got worse faster than I could lower my standards. You know, if that makes sense to you. Oh, you know what? I was in a meeting recently. A bunch of us go to a morning meeting together, and there's this woman leading the meeting, and she's talking about when she was a kid, she and her sister would go trick-or-treating, and they'd come home with these sacks full of candy, and, you know, her sister would, like, want to stash hers and put it away for future use, and so she'd eat this, the other woman would eat all her own candy, and then she'd go eat her sister's, find it and steal it and whatever, and for some reason, this thing clicks in my mind about when I was a kid. I hadn't thought about this in a long time. You know, when I was maybe 10 years old, still living at home with my family, I used to get an allowance. And, you know, I would look forward to Saturday or whatever day it was. I was, you know, getting my allowance. And my allowance was just enough to go down to the liquor store and get 6 bottles of pop. Now, you could get 6 different bottles, you know. You could get a knee-high grape, and you could get a RC Cola, and you could get a Green River, and, you know. And I would have all this planned out, and I'd get my 6 sodas because they were going to last me for a week. And I'd go home with them. And, you know, 2 hours later, I got 6 empty bottles sitting there. And I'm thinking, man, I feel kind of sick. Yeah. Well, I won't do that again. Any of this sounding familiar to you guys? You know, I hadn't thought about that in years and years. But, you know, obviously, I carried that forward with me. You know, I was introduced to alcohol at a very young age, I'm sure, because my folks were not alcoholics, and they both would occasionally have one, and they were the kind of people, if you said, can I try that, they'd hand it to you. And I'm sure that, you know, I did that at some point, tasted something, and went, pooh, that stuff's terrible. You know, I didn't get enough in me to experience the magic and all that stuff. I just thought, this stuff tastes like crap. And so I was not a big fan of alcohol, or wasn't drawn toward it. But I sure liked that soda pop, you know. I'm growing up in Van Nuys, California. And the first substances I'm introduced to are, you know, outside issues, they call them now. Somebody says, hey, man, you got to try this, this pot. Okay. And I'm maybe 14 years old. I'm sitting in the back of this old Chevy. There's 4 of us. We're passing this stuff around. It's that old Mexican dirt weed that, you know, you had to smoke a lot of it to. And I'm smoking and smoking, and I'm going, you know, nah, nothing's happening. Nothing's. Something's happening. We took off riding in that car, and I'd ridden in it a lot of times before, and I knew it didn't have any shocks or springs. And now all of a sudden it's on air cushions, you know. We're doing a fast 15 miles an hour down the street, you know. 4 little vatos, you could see about this much of us, you know. Went to a place called Beep's Hamburgers, corner of Sherman Way and Woodley. This is how long ago this was. They sold hamburgers 5 for a dollar. I had a dollar's worth. They had changed the recipe. These things were good. Really good. It wasn't long after that somebody said, hey man, try these, and gave me a handful of pills, and I went, what were they? He said, oh, those are 10-grain Benzedrine tablets. I said, what's going to happen? He says, just hang on, you'll find out. This was to establish a pattern in my life, this whole just try it, you'll find out thing, you know. But, you know, 10 minutes later, bzzz, all the hair on the back of my head stood up. Man, let me tell you the story of my life in detail. I like the speed because that's when I started to learn how to drink. You know, I had tried drinking up to before that, but I always, it took me to getting sober to figure this out. I had tried drinking, but I didn't really particularly care for it because I always got drunk. Now, there might have been people around me who had their little two cans of that country club malt liquor and stopped and copped a buzz and were, you know, fine at the party. That wasn't me. I just, you know, I'm slamming them down with both hands. I end up puking all over myself and other people. You know, I get in a fight because I get a mouth on me, you know, and I get beat up always. And, you know, that's kind of the story of how I understand drinking. But now all of a sudden I got this other substance, swallow a couple of them bennies, I'm good to go. And that beer isn't getting me there at least quite as fast. You know, I can make it till midnight at least. So, you know, I shot my first heroin when I was 17 years old. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I justify, if I need to, what I'm telling you, because all this played a part in my alcoholism. You know, Benny's helped me drink. I used heroin sometimes to keep from drinking, because it's kind of hard to get a drink down when your head's like this, you know. It also gave me the illusion of some control over the substance alcohol. You know, I'd just be asleep or kind of. But, I abused everything that I came in contact with. I was 19 years old. I had just turned 19 years old. I shot and killed my older brother in a fight over drugs. We weren't fighting about the possession of them. We were fighting about the way I used them. We'd had a lot of fights in our lives, and he always won. And he was a lot bigger and meaner than me. And, you know, he thought he was going to be able to beat me into stopping using and drinking the way that I was. And I had a pistol and I used it. I was convicted of the crime of second-degree murder. I committed that crime while under the influence of alcohol and narcotics. That's not an excuse. That's just the facts of the case. You know, I had to get to you people too. For years, I used that as an excuse. Well, I was drunk. You know, something stupid and sideways would happen. I'd say, yeah, but I was drunk. And I arrived with you people, and you told me, you know, you drank that intentionally, and what happens after that is your fault. You know, you can't lay it off on, I was drunk. You need to accept responsibility for your actions. So I went upstate. I had an A number, if that means anything to anybody here. And one important thing happened while I was there. I mean, many things happened. I had, you know, prison's an interesting place. But this guy that was selling next to me said, hey, man, you're a writer. You go to that writer's club, don't you? I'm like, yeah, man, I'm a poet. He says, well, I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, why don't you invite me down to your meeting? I'll invite you to mine, and we can spread our hustle. So I went to my first AA meetings, 1965, 66, 67, somewhere, you know. I went not because I was an alcoholic or had any kind of problem. I went because it got me out of my cell, because there was coffee there. Sometimes there was pastry. Free people came in from outside. Some of them were women, you know, real women. And I enjoyed it. Chuck Chamberlain came in there and spoke to us. You know, I sat in the back with my yard coat all buttoned up to my neck, wearing my shades at night, and I came to scoff, and I did not remain to pray at that point in my life. But fast forward, I got out when I was 24. I got sober when I was 38. So, you know, from the time I was 24 until I was 38, my disease just progressed. I managed to stay out of prison, stay out, you know, got busted a couple of times, beat cases on technicalities. You know, the time came when I was done, when things had gotten worse faster than I could lower my standards, and I'm living homeless in Sacramento, California. I'm eating out of dumpsters. I'm begging for money on the street. Homeless. A few things happened, you know. November of 1982, I approached the last friend of mine who was still speaking to me. My family cut me loose, all my friends, all my old, those old ladies of mine and my homeboys, and, you know, all that stuff was gone. And I was alone. Had one friend still speaking to me. She picked me up and took me over to her mom's house, and her mom made up this little job for me. It was made up. I moved some boxes around. I swept her garage. She gave me $20. I spent half of it on wine and half of it on a bus ticket to Chico. And I did what all tough guys like me do when they're in a situation like I was in. I went home to my mom, you know. And I arrived at mom's drunk, as I had many times before. And when she answered the door, I said to her with all of the arrogance of the practicing alcoholic, "Don't worry about anything, Mom. I'm here to take care of you." And Mom, bless her heart, said, "No. You're dying. I can't stand to watch it. So if it's what you got to do, you've got to do it somewhere else. Here's $20. I spent half of it on wine, half of it on a bus ticket back to Sacramento, and rode away thinking, man, what just happened? My ace in the hole. See, all this stuff I'm telling you about, if you had asked me about any of it, about going to prison, about, you know, all this pitiful, you know, homelessness and loss of family, loss of friends. You know, Tim, what's the reason? I would have told you, you know, I've had a long series of bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances, and people who don't understand. That's the problem. The problem is out there. Bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances, people who don't understand. Now, this is just another in a long series of these. Mom doesn't understand. Man, I'm just having a little fun, you know? Just trying to have a little fun. Not hurting anybody. I really, I think I could have been hooked up to a lie detector. You know, I'm not hurting anybody. Well, maybe it's hurting me a little, but, you know, that's my choice. I could not see the impact I was having on the people around me, on the fact that most of them were gone, you know. The reason for that, it was just bad breaks. It was unfortunate circumstances. So I get back to Sacramento, and I go for a Thanksgiving meal at the Salvation Army. There were so many people waiting for that meal that they were handing out color-coded tickets. I was a member of the blue group. And I'm, you know, we're all standing outside 12th and C, I think, in Sacramento, and there's all this traffic going by. And I think, man, I hope nobody I know goes by and sees me, because I, you know, they won't understand that I don't belong here. You know, this is bad breaks. This is unfortunate circumstances. And I looked down at myself, and I looked at the guys I was with, and I realized I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and that I had put myself there. And I hated that. I hated that information. But there's something about the truth. You know, when you hear it, it goes to that place inside you where truth resides, and you can't deny it. And I knew it was true. Oh my God, I put myself here. And I gave somebody my ticket and I left. I went and got something to drink as fast as possible, and I drank as much as possible. Just I didn't want this information rattling around in my head. It wasn't long after that I was tramping around with this guy named Bob. Bob the Wino. We're drunk somewhere and he looks at me and he says, you know we're dying? You know that? It's like, yeah, I don't care. Just taking so damn long. He says, I'll tell you what, man. I get a little money at the first of the month. Why don't we go to Santa Barbara and get sober? And I said, sure. Now, he could have said, why don't we go to Denver and get drunk? And I would have said, sure. You know, I focused in on the fact that you got a little money at the first of the month. This was new information for me. But he was a man of his word. First of the month came, he bought us bus tickets. We traveled down there together. On the way down, he says, we'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous when we get down there. I went, oh yeah, AA, I know all about that. I went when I was in the joint. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew everything about everything. Just ask me. You know, we were drunk on that trip and drunk in town for a few days, and we got separated from each other. I didn't see him for 6 weeks. 6 weeks later, when I did see him, I was 6 weeks sober. I was 6 weeks sober because when I went trying to find him, I thought he mentioned AA, and I looked it up in the phone book and made that phone call. That phone call. Woman answers the phone. I said, have you seen Bob? She said, I know a few Bobs, honey, and how are you doing? You know, we talked briefly, and I hung up the phone, went and got some more to drink. So, well, I'll walk up there. I'd seen the address. I knew I could find it. Walked to central office. I didn't know that's what it was. It just said Alcoholics Anonymous in the phone book. I thought I was going, you know, to the whole deal. I didn't know about churches and Alano clubs and all the places, you know, all this stuff I found out later. I walked in and this woman says, oh, you're that man looking for his friend. You know, I still haven't seen him, but I know some guys who would just love to talk to you. What do you think? Sure. That was Gertrude. Gertrude, God. You know, 15 years later, Gertrude died. And by that time, I had her job, her old job. And her family called me and said, you know, our mom just thought so highly of you. We wonder if you officiated her memorial service. So I hope I helped her go out peacefully, because I know she helped me come in, brought me in out of the cold. I began this journey into recovery, and I haven't, you know, Gertrude made a phone call, wrote out some directions for me, gave me a piece of paper. I left central office. I'm going to where she sent me. Halfway there, I found a bar, and I had some money, and I walked in, and as I recall, I had three drinks. I had those drinks because I had a sneaking hunch I was on my way to get sober. Does that make sense to you? I see some heads nodding out there, you know. You know, a guy's got to have some liquor in him if he's going to go get sober. But a guy named Dennis met me at the door and said, "You Tim? You don't look too good." I thought, this Dennis is a master of understatement. But he talked to me, and I haven't had a drink, you know. Next day, I mean, I spent the night there at the club. They let me sleep there. And next day, a guy came by and said, "We talked the day before," and he said, "Oh, I'm glad to see you're still here." He says, "I'm on my way to an AA meeting. I thought maybe you'd like to go with me." Sure. He says, "You know, we got a little time. You want to stop at my house and take a shower?" I'm like, shower? Oh, you know, I was filthy. I've been sleeping in the same clothes for months. Things were crawling on me. Felt like it, you know. Having a lot of involuntary muscle movement, you know. We stopped and took a shower. I took a shower at his house. And when I got out, he laid out a clean pair of socks for me. You know, white gym socks. And I'll never forget how they went, how they felt going on my feet. The pair I'd been wearing was walking around by themselves. You know, things were greasy. And he took me to that meeting, and we talked, and he gave me a big book. I still have that big book. It's all beat up and marked up and, you know, highlighted and stuff written in the margins. And I need the large print version nowadays anyway, even with my glasses. But I have that book still, and it's in my bookcase, place of honor. What I don't ever want to forget is on that day, the socks meant more to me than the book did. There's a lot of fantastic, I've read this book probably literally thousands of times now. I read it. Prefer to read it these days in the company of other people so I can get some input other than my own head. But I have a fair idea of what it talks about in here. And I, you know, if you're new, I'd recommend you get a good idea of what it says in here too. But I don't ever want to forget that on that day the socks were more important to me. I don't ever want to forget that it's crucial for me to meet people at the point of their need. You know, that sometimes what they need is a pair of socks. And sometimes what they need is a sandwich. And sometimes they need a drink. What they always, always, always need is that most precious gift that we have to give them, which is our time and our attention. Maybe it doesn't happen up here in Orchid, but there are people that it seems to me try to force feed this literature to people, and they try to force feed it to them at their speed, not at the speed that the person's able to get it. So if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad you're here. We want you to know that you're welcome in this fellowship, that you're not alone anymore, that you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. I believe that now because it's been my own experience. And I would suggest reading this book. But, you know, I would also suggest getting a dictionary and finding out what some of those words mean. You know, and taking and studying in your own way. And if you can't read, then get somebody to read it to you. But draw your own conclusions about what it's saying. Don't let anybody force you into anything. You know, we don't have any bosses around here. We don't have any bullies. My understanding of the way the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works is, you know, go to meetings, don't drink in between meetings. Get a copy of this book, read it. Read it in the company of other people. Find someone with more time and experience in recovery than you have. Have that person help you learn about this literature and about our program and our steps. Develop a relationship with a power greater than yourself. Maintain a conscious contact with that entity that you discover. And then reach your hand back and try and help the next guy along. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Read the book. Get a sponsor. Work the steps. Find God. Help somebody. It works. It works really well. You know, I always realize right at that point, this is what I have done. And it's worked for me really well. And that experience leads me to think, it might work for you too. If you're out of answers, then give this one a shot. I try very hard not to tell anybody what they should do or have to do, or I'm just not that guy. But here's what I've done. And having done it, my experience tells me that perhaps this will work for you too. I'm way past this point, but Lee asked me to tell a story. So this is from my early days prior to drinking. I'm standing on the schoolyard at Cohasset Street Elementary School. I'm with my little crew. Somebody says, "Hey man, try this. Squat down. Take a bunch of deep breaths. Stand up, blow on your thumbs." I said, "Why? What's going to happen?" He says, "Just try it. You'll find out." This was to establish a pattern in my life, this whole "just try it, you'll find out" thing. But I did it. And I passed out, because that's what happens when you do that. I come to him laying on the schoolyard, the world's spinning, I'm all disoriented. It's like, wow, cool. Everybody else in the little group did it, then they all ran off to play dodgeball. I stayed there and did it 8 or 10 more times. Anyway, where was I at in all this business? So I began this journey into recovery. I got sober at the Salvation Army, living at the ARC. And I always say, God bless the Salvation Army. It's outside Enterprise, but man, they gave me that step up off of street level. I started going to AA meetings. I got a sponsor. I started reading this book. I started doing the things that we do around here. And I've never looked back. You know, it's just been... I've had a great life. I worked for a company named Kinko's. I got a job when I was about 2 years sober. And they were just getting going, that company. And I came on just at the right time. I'll tell you how I got hired. I was a temp through an agency, a temp agency, and they sent me out to do this job, and I'm looking around going, "This is kind of a cool place." I'm packing boxes for them. But I had told this company, you know, "Don't give me anything that lasts longer than a week, because I don't know what I want to do with my life." So I worked for a week, and they said, "Can you stay another week?" I was like, "Okay. Can you stay another week?" Pretty soon, I'm there for a couple of months. I'm really digging it. And the supervisor came to me and said, "You know, the department's really been doing well, and we think you have played a part in that. And we're going to take everybody out to dinner, the whole department. We want you to come. We're going to celebrate. Going to meet at Cold Springs Tavern. You know, bring your wife." So I go to this dinner, and you know, everybody orders a drink. They say, "What do you drink?" I say, "Oh, nothing, thanks." "Oh, don't you drink?" It's like, no, not normally. And, and they kind of looked at me and I said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 2 years. And the president of the corporation was there with us and he says, oh, I'm in Al-Anon. And we started talking. And the next day they hired me, or they hired me, they gave me a job, hired me on. I was with them for 12 years. Great. I thought I was going to die there. I mean, you know, be there till I die, because it was a wonderful place to work. That's where I got a chance to hire Lenny, my friend Leonard. He worked for me there. You know, I worked my way into supervision and had a little department that I ran, and it was good. And then I got injured on the job, and I was out for a year with my back and doctors and procedures and all kinds of stuff. And the time came for me to go back, and I realized, you know, I think I'm done with that. And I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not too scared because I'm sober in AA for 15 years by that point. And I just, you know, I believed that God had me in the palm of his hand. And it was at that point that the chairperson of Intergroup approached me and said, hey, we need a new manager at Central Office. You think you want that job? I said, yes, I do. You know, I get to be Gertrude now. Yeah. I love that job. It was good. Got a chance to do a lot of stuff. Be right in the middle of AA. And I can tell you that it's not easy to answer to everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because everybody's got their opinion, and everybody thinks they're right, and everybody wants you to fix something for them, you know. You need to come to our group and tell so-and-so to get straightened out. And that's like, no, I don't. You know. But here's a pamphlet, you know. Maybe some information in there that will help you. Talks about group conscience. Talks about traditions. You know, I learned a lot in that job. And got the opportunity to do many things, but the thing that means the most to me in Alcoholics Anonymous, the thing that has helped me the most, I think, and is the most important to me is, you know, I've been out of prison so long, they let me go back in. And I've been doing hospital and institution work for a long time now, various facilities. I've had a panel at CMC East in San Luis Obispo for a number of years. I also go into the federal penitentiary, thanks to my friend Lee. Been doing that for a number of years. And that, you know, I may be wrong, but I think that those guys maybe can hear me just a little bit better because I'm able to say to them, I was here, and I know where you are. And I know something about the life you live in here, and I know there's a way out for you. You know, they've done research that indicates somewhere between 75 and 95% of people who were incarcerated had alcohol and or drugs played a part in their crime. They might not be convicted of something directly related to it, but they were probably drinking and or using. The yard I go with, the state yard I go into in San Luis Obispo is level 3. Most of the guys are lifers. Most of them killed somebody the way I killed somebody. You know, I can tell you how fast that can happen. Have a few drinks, pull a trigger. Your whole life changes. So what I tell them is, if that sounds familiar to you, you might want to look into Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I can also tell you that some of those guys in there are sober a lot longer than me. Some of them have been there for a long time. I mean, a long time. And may end up being there for the rest of their lives. You know, there was a man who got up. When we do the panel, we talk and they talk, and it's all this mix of stuff. And so one of the convicts is talking, and he's just got denied by the parole board again, and he's kind of boo-hooing about it a little, and it's understandable. He sat down, and the next guy got up, next convict, and he says, "My name's Andy, and I'm doing life without the possibility of parole. And what I find it necessary to do is practice the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life so that I can be comfortable no matter where I am." And I turned to the people I was with and said, "We can go home now. You know, heard everything I needed to hear." So this H and I work, you know, we say, in Santa Barbara, we say 96% of the people who do H and I work stay sober. We made that statistic up. I think it recently got bumped to 97, but you know, I don't know if there's ever been any actual tracking on that, but I know that that myself and the crew that I run with, we all do H&I work and we're all sober. And I think that plays a big part in it. So I eventually retired from central office, and my wife said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to be retired." She said, "Yeah, but what are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to be retired. You know, I'll go on my panels, I'll go to my meetings, play a little golf, and be a retired guy." She said, "No. You need to find something to do." I guess the prospect of me sitting around in my underwear watching Gilligan's Island reruns just wasn't attractive to her the way it was to me, you know. She said, "You know, you always talk about how when you were younger you used to do some acting and how you'd like to do some again." She said, "Why don't you, you know, get involved in that? Go up to City College, take an acting class." So I went up to City College and signed up, scared to death. You know, I had quit school in the ninth grade, completely unscarred by education. And now I'm going to college. But I liked it. Kids were nice, made me feel welcome. Got to start learning some stuff, you know, getting up on my feet, acting. You know, to be or not to be. I liked it. And as a result of being involved in that activity, somebody came that I had met and said, "Hey, we're auditioning for this play. Why don't you come and try out?" "Okay, what is it?" 12 Angry Men. It's like, "What's it about?" "It's about being on a jury." I said, "Well, I'm got a lot more experience being the guy in the orange jumpsuit, but, you know, yeah, I'll give it a shot." And I got a part, juror number 9, and fell in love with it. Scary. Oh, my God. We opened that show. We walked out on stage the first night with an audience. I sat down at the table and realized I had just forgotten everything. Everything. Oh, my God. What am I going to do? I'm going to have to get up and leave. That's it. You know, I'll apologize to these other guys later, but I just can't sit here like a dummy. And then one guy delivered his line, another guy delivered his line, and I delivered mine. Wow, I knew that one. Okay, I'll sit here a little bit longer. It's scary. Being up on the high wire, you know, in front of a live audience. couple of years ago, I got cast in a movie. Find out I like movie work better because you can retake it, you know. But shot a film, and now I just recently shot another one in Santa Barbara called A Rabbi, a Priest, and a Goomba Walk into a Bank. I got to play the rabbi. We rob a bank, and I'm waiting for it to come out. Anyway, that's my life these days. I'm a retired guy who does a little acting, and got a crew that I run with. My life is just so, at some point in my sobriety, I became an ordained minister, and that's how I performed me and Joey's wedding. It was a beautiful ceremony, beautiful bride. She was so lovely. You should have seen her out by the beach. What was that town called? Los Osos. Yeah, Los Osos on the beach. It was nice. Nice to be there for my friends. When I'm still working at central office, I'm sitting there one day and the volunteer hasn't shown up because whatever, sometimes they don't show up. So I get to answer the phones. Now, I got to always take myself off the clock mentally because, I'm getting paid, and you can't get paid to do 12-step work, which is what happens when you answer the phone frequently. But I'm alone, so I've got to answer the phone. Phone rings and this woman says, "I wonder if you could help me. I came to town yesterday with a friend of mine and she got hurt and she's in Cottage Hospital. She's still not ready to get out and I can't leave her and I had to spend last night in a motel and I really can't afford motels. But, I'm not in any danger of drinking. I'm 12 years sober. I just need to talk to somebody. Can you talk to me?" And I said, "Absolutely. But you know what? I'm sitting here alone. The other line's ringing. I'm going to have to put you on hold. I'll get right back to you." Pick up the other line, and the young woman said, "Can you help me? I can't seem to stop drinking, and I don't know what to do." And I connected line one to line two. They came by the office later that day. They were both okay because they were thinking about each other. That's what you guys taught me. When I can take my mind up off of myself, off of all my bad breaks, unfortunate circumstances, and the people who don't understand, when I can give a moment of thought to you and your well-being, I'm always a better man for it. Thank you for listening tonight.